Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. We are coming to you today on Monday, March the 2nd, to talk about the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran and the subsequent armed conflict that has followed. With me today are my Bruegel colleagues Simone Tagliapietra, Elena Rybakova, and Guntram Wolf, and we are going to be talking particularly about what this means for energy markets, for Europe, for the war that was already going on between Russia and Ukraine, and the broader consequences for the world. Simone, you have a new piece out talking specifically about how this really challenges global energy markets and the balance that the EU had hoped to find with its energy supplies after cutting ties mostly with Russia.
Yes. So first of all, I think what we are seeing with the strikes on Iran is possibly one of the most consequential energy security issues in the global economy, and that is certainly the disruption of Middle Eastern oil and gas flows through what is the world's most important energy choke point, the Strait of Hormuz. I think it's worth recalling how 20 million barrels per day of oil and petroleum products transit through Hormuz, which makes basically 20% of the global oil trade, as well as 110 billion cubic meters a year of liquefied natural gas, which amounts to 20% of global LNG trade. So we are talking about the most relevant oil transit and LNG transit point on Earth. And what is happening there is almost unprecedented disruption of this transit, which as we have seen this morning, pushed prices to the roof. So we see oil today spiking some 8%, the European gas prices spiking 20%, and more to come according to the duration of this situation. Of course, time will be the key variable to understand the implication of all of these on the global energy markets and therefore also on the European landscape. It is important to say that Europe is not so much directly exposed to these Middle Eastern supplies as Asia is. 80% of this oil and gas almost goes to Asia, indeed. But the second round effects are immediate because both oil and LNG are global markets. So if this oil and gas doesn't get out of Hormuz, at that point, of course, Europe will need to compete with Asia when it comes, for example, to LNG cargoes. And that is something we have seen during the energy crisis a few years ago. And that's what will likely make gas prices structurally higher in the coming days and weeks, as well as, of course, ripple effect on electricity prices, which is exactly what policy makers in Europe and European leaders wanted to bring down with all the recent push on competitiveness, energy prices, which is something, by the way, that leaders are also due to discuss at the European Council of March. So the situation is, of course, extremely sensitive. The International Energy Agency is monitoring the security of oil supply and stands ready in case of an emergency to allow, of course, the member states, including all European countries, to release their strategic oil storage, oil stocks, in order to counterbalance eventual price spikes. When it comes to gas, the situation is more complex because we do not have much storage in Europe, unfortunately, at the moment. We have been drying storage very fast this winter, and that means that in case of a prolonged shortage of this LNG to the global markets, we will need to take emergency measures, which we have seen during the energy crisis, including, for example, demand-side reduction, or at least certain measures to do some fuel switching whenever possible in order to decrease the consumption of gas into the system. So let's see. This is not for now, but certainly policymakers in Europe and beyond need to prepare contingency plans to deal with an eventual emergency, should that be necessary.
The shock comes so soon, really, after the need to completely divest from Russian energy. Elena, what does all of this mean for the standoff between the EU and Russia and, of course, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's very interesting to start from looking at what Russia's political and press and the bloggers' messaging has been in the last few days. I think, first of all, it has been definitely more forward than regarding Venezuela, but it still has been very muted. Russia has replayed old clips by Putin that Putin has tried to mediate the conflict specifically with Iran over the last 20 years. I think they brought it back as early 2000s, comments that Putin was giving to the president of the US at the time and the Europeans. And Russia says now, look, we cannot be peacemakers of the world. We're already fighting this evil warmongering forces in another place. We're alluding to Ukraine. And therefore, we can only do so much for Iran. They're also saying that formally, supposedly, Iran hasn't requested support, and that's why Russia is not giving any support. So the way I would translate it is that Russia doesn't have capacity, neither the willingness to confront, obviously, US and Israel directly, and therefore it's sort of stepping back, giving the rhetoric, but of course not doing anything practical for Iran. At the same, so this is, I think, the first point. The second point, I think they're watching very carefully in regarding the discussion domestically and internationally about regime changes. The official sort of comment by the US, of course, and the pressure is for the change in regime in Iran, just like we have seen the debate around or rhetoric around Venezuela. For Russia, it is very significant. They're watching very carefully. And their domestic political analysts are saying that, look, the first reaction after external pressure is to consolidate power around the leader. Fine, the leader has been, has died, has been killed, but that means that the elites will be more careful and will not go for liberalization. Instead, they will have to hardline to be able to protect their power. And I think they're talking as much about Russia as they're talking about Iran. And I think this is very significant. That's what Russia is trying to take away. In terms of the practical things, and this is the third one and the last, is Russia's budget will benefit from higher oil prices. This is a direct important support. Russia already earlier this year was forced to start revising the budget, looking for changes because they were falling behind targets. The oil revenue forecast for Urals of about 59 was overly optimistic, and therefore they had to change it. Well, they were already beginning to discuss the changes. But of course, now it gives them an important boost. So the revenues will go up. At the same time, ruble will also go up. That will help them on fighting inflation. It will, on the margin, mute the positive effect on the budget. But nonetheless, the effect on the budget is positive. The effect on the ruble and inflation in the short term is positive. Of course, Russia has been through many oil price cycles. And as Simone has explained, it might not last for the rest of the year. And therefore, I think they will be cautious, sort of, not overspending these gains.
Sobering assessment. Guntram, what does all this mean for Europe? As we are recording this, Friedrich Merz is in Washington, the German chancellor, meeting with the U.S. administration. We've seen statements of muted support from Canada, the U.K., and France and Germany. What do we make of it?
Well, I mean, this is a broad issue, and let me start perhaps with three very direct economic channels before talking a bit more about the politics. I think the first channel that Simona already talked about is the energy price shock, and the question is what does it do to the European economy macroeconomic wise. And there, the good news is that at the moment, inflation rates are below the ECB target. So I don't think this will drive inflation up so much that the ECB will be forced to act. And in any case, the ECB and other central banks, they will always try to look through this first price shock coming from energy prices and only act at a much later stage when there are second round effects in terms of higher wage negotiations. So I don't think interest rates will rise in Europe as a consequence, at least not in the next couple of months, if at all this starts like in half a year or something like this. So that's I would say, the first positive response. Now, economically, of course, negatively, it is in terms of trade shock. So it takes away purchasing power from European consumers for domestic products. And it means sending more money to those that still sell globally oil and gas. And so that weighs on consumption, it weighs on the European recovery, and it weighs in particular on sort of trying to reinvigorate a more domestic-led growth model in Europe. So I think there we have a net negative. So overall, in terms of GDP, it's going to be negative. In terms of inflation, a little bit, but not that big at this point. Now, in terms of the military markets, which I think is a very important dimension, obviously, because we are supporting Ukraine in defending itself against Russia. And we are, by the way, also regularly attacked with hybrid attacks by Russia. So what does it mean? Well, I think the key point here is that the US, as well as its allies in the Gulf, are expensing air defense and attack weapons at a very rapid rate. And it's very cost ineffective. So basically the ratio is whatever Iran shoots at Israel or the Gulf or American bases, to fend it off costs 10 times as much as what the Iranians sent. So there is a lot of money being burned there, but really also a lot of products, air defense products, for example, air defense missiles, that of course will have to be replenished. And that means the global demand for these kind of products is going up. The US and Israel will have to buy more of it. And that means, given that supply is quite constrained, that we will see shortages of this kind of stuff going to Ukraine, but also Taiwan has already seen that some of the already agreed deliveries might be delayed, and so on and so forth. So this has major implications also for European security. And of course, what it means for Europe is, in my view, that we have to strengthen our domestic production of both air defense as well as deep strike capabilities. The last point is the political one that you mentioned. Of course, the big question is, how should Europe position itself in this war? I think for me, it would be a mistake to fully endorse Trump's and Netanyahu's war. First of all, because I don't think either of those two leaders have a plan, a long-term plan of what to do with Iran. I mean, there's one thing to take out some missiles, and even the headquarters of the Iran Revolutionary Guard. But that doesn't mean regime change. And of course, we know that regime changes don't happen from some bombs falling on a country. They don't happen automatically at all. If at all, the U.S. would have to go into Iran, which would be extremely difficult. And so I don't think that's really in our interest as Europeans. I think, you know, we don't like the Iranian regime. That's true. But we are not in the business of trying to change regimes around the world. The U.S. has tried so and has failed so many, many times before. And so I think it's a mistake, actually, if we openly endorse the regime change rhetoric, as Ursula von der Leyen has done it, unfortunately. The Commission President has done it. And I think it would be an even bigger mistake if the big European countries, such as the E3 declaration of Germany, France, and the UK, seems to suggest if these countries were ready to actually go at war themselves with Iran. I think basically you should only enter into a war if you have clearly defined objectives and you know how to achieve them. Otherwise, it's I think basically a lost case.
Simone, what's your assessment of the political implications of this?
Well, I think I would fully subscribe what Guntram said, and I think we have been there in the past, no? From Iraq to Afghanistan to also the consequences of the so-called Arab Spring in North Africa are illustrative of the fact that the idea of bringing about regime change with external action is something that simply does not deliver. And I think Europe needs to possibly position itself in a very prudent manner here and consider what are our interests at stake, but also be aware of what are our tools, because I'm not sure that Europe has actually a big leverage in this scenario of the Middle East today, and I think that is true for the defense sector and all the military implications, of course, but also, as mentioned before, that is very true when it comes to the purely geoeconomic and energy dimension of this story. So I think we need to be very much aware of our limits, possibly also of the different perspectives that are there across Europe when it comes to what to do next. And for this reason, we might want to take a prudent approach here.
So we are economists, and as you've heard in the first round, we collectively are seeing possible increases in energy prices, help or good effects, strengthening effects for the Russian economy, and real pressures on the European economy. That's quite a whammy to have coming toward us, Guntram. Is there something that we can do or that we should do?
The best moment to prepare for something like this is, of course, 5 years ago or 2 years ago. It's not at the moment when it strikes. I mean, when your gas tanks are relatively empty and when your weapon supplies are under constraint, I mean, to ramp all of that up very quickly is actually not so easy. So I think short term, for sure, on the military side, I would emphasize direct weapon purchases to the domestic industrial base, European producers. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that now you can buy Patriot anti-aircraft missiles and get them delivered in any reasonable period of time. You're just not going to get it. Go ask for the French and the Italian alternatives or the German alternatives for it, right? And build on those and the Ukrainian. And in the so that's for sure. I think we need to be aware that in terms of our relation with Russia, I think it's probably overall more of a net positive for Russia, as absurdly as it might sound. I mean, of course, Russia seems to be losing an ally, and that ally hasn't delivered that many weapons in the last 6 months or so to Russia, and so it's net positive to Russia because energy prices are higher, and so this means Russia has more resources to fight its war in Ukraine. So, yeah, and I think on the energy supplies, I mean, you're better placed to talk about this, but basically, I would let prices play out and sort of see that demand is responding to higher prices. And so we are trying to save in the short term. Long term, it's all about the green transition. But you might want to say something on that.
Yes, indeed. I think in the short term, there is very little that can be done on prices, right? I think this situation, unfortunately, illustrates that in a way Europe has quickly forgotten the lessons of the energy crisis. Over the last year, there have been a lot of talks, for example, around the EU natural gas refilling targets that certain countries, Germany, France, others, didn't want any longer. So there was a sense, you know, that somehow we were back to business as usual with, you know, new suppliers, of course, the United States instead of Russia, but we could somehow be a bit more relaxed. That is, of course, not true. Europe is a continent that has a systemic vulnerability when it comes to its energy system, to its energy supplies, and we will not get rid of this vulnerability until we will be able to produce the energy we need predominantly domestically, namely from renewable energy sources, right? So I think the structural solution here is certainly the energy transition. And I think this situation comes at a moment when a few countries, Italy, others, over the course of the last couple of weeks, were calling for a suspension of the European carbon market, for instance, which would be a total dismantling of the European climate policy. So claiming that the carbon market was the driver of the high electricity prices, for example, in Italy and elsewhere. Now, I think this situation will show that the driver of high energy costs in Europe, high electricity costs in Europe, is not the carbon market, is actually the reliance on volatile natural gas, and that's what we need to target. That's what we need to diminish as quickly as possible as we move forward. And therefore, out of this situation, we might be learning once more that, first of all, coordination at the EU level matters when it comes to energy security. And second, we need to double down on the energy transition, because that's for Europe really a geopolitical project by now. It's not just a climate project any longer.
It's funny, it wasn't that long ago that we were debating the lack of solar panel manufacturing in Europe as a sign of Europe's decline. You wrote, I thought very credibly and convincingly, that Europe should buy all the cheap solar panels it can and electrify as much as possible. How do we look at that now? I mean, you're certainly saying we need to speed up the green transition. But also, can we finally set to rest this idea that Europe needs to have a fully internal supply chain on this and instead can work with what's out there?
Well, that's exactly, you know, one of the most relevant economic policy questions of these very months, because the Commission is about to present an Industrial Accelerator Act that many hope will push these Made in Europe provisions, right? While, as you say, we have been calling always for a much more open, I would say smarter, approach to industrial policy, which doesn't want to, you know, foster protectionism and domestic reshoring in Europe, but really try to work with partners out there in order to diversify our supply chains and try to achieve our resilience goals, which are legitimate, in a cost-effective manner. And the very idea of trying to manufacture in Europe all the technologies we need for the transition is simply silly. It's not going to happen. We, you know, comparative advantages still matter out there, and we need to identify where we are good at, build on them, and certainly get smarter at subsidizing European manufacturers when they are innovative. But then, for those technologies where we do not have a comparative advantage, the answer is not forced reshoring, is building partnerships with other like-minded countries around the world and try to work with them around that de-risking strategy away from China, which is, of course, a predominant supplier in this space. And we do need to do something about that, but we need to get smarter at that approach.
Guntram, what does this mean for EU-China relations? I do want to come back to the Russia thing, but I'd like to stick with this for a second.
I think the first key point is that China is, of course, a major importer of oil, and is affected by the fact that the U.S. Increases its control of global oil supplies. I mean, it's being the biggest, one of the biggest oil producers in the U.S. itself. Now they brought Venezuela under their umbrella, if I can put it like this. And now it's basically the Middle East being under the U.S. stick. So that has implications for China. And so it will drive China more towards Russia, because Russia is a big oil supplier. And, you know, that makes Russian oil more attractive relative to the Iranian that certainly cannot be exported. As a result, I mean, it pushes China further away from trying to have a better relation with Europe, right? And so in that sense, I think it's a net negative for the EU-China relation. And, you know, I personally think that as I said already, I think we Europeans, also given that we have very limited instruments, I personally don't think we should be so involved in this conflict. I mean, the more we stay out of it, the more we also have a chance of having a relatively reasonable relation with China, which I guess then, well, I mean, that's a complicated matter, right? But I mean, it has many dimensions. But certainly, as I said, I think the relation with just endorsing the war by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, and let's not forget that Donald Trump got to power claiming that he would never do a war in Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So he is doing something that not even his own population is endorsing. And so sort of for us to now endorse this, I think it would be a mistake, which doesn't mean that I like the Iranian regime, but it's just, I think, politically wrong.
It does keep coming back to that, how everyone positions themselves, given that many of the world's Western countries have supported Israel after the original Hamas attacks that began the war there. Then we had all of the things that followed the debate about the mass casualties in Gaza. Europe has never come up with a united view on how to tackle that with Israel. And now the Israelis have gone to war with the Trump administration. So it's quite a mess. And last question on China is, Simone, do you see a potential for more business back and forth despite all of this buy Europe potential? Should Europe now go and buy a bunch of supplies while it can? And could that foster some sort of a channel to perhaps keep diplomatic communication open?
Well, I mean, when it comes to Industrial Accelerator Act, you mentioned industrial policy, I think Europe should try to have a negotiation with the Chinese, right? I think when it comes to the trade measures we put in place on electric vehicles and the possibility of a negotiation around them, I think there is here space, also given the current domestic vulnerabilities in China. We know that the domestic market is not doing great, and therefore there is a huge overcapacity, that, by the way, cannot be exported to the United States, given the wall of tariffs that was built there. And therefore, Europe and China are in this situation where China also needs the European market for the export of its own companies, including EVs producers. Now, I think there is here the possibility to say, okay, let's attract more FDIs from China in Europe when it comes to EVs and battery manufacturing, which, by the way, we are seeing already flourishing around Europe with certain conditionalities that we need to set as Europeans in order to reflect our societal goals, right? And I think there is certainly the scope to be a bit smarter when it comes, for example, to the allocation of our subsidies, so to make sure that whenever European taxpayer money is granted to a certain manufacturing plants or also for purchasing subsidies of electric vehicles, etc., these also contribute to certain resilience and sustainability criteria. So I think the question here is not to target a specific country like China, but is try to accommodate our sustainability and resilience needs in a smarter way when we design our industrial policy. And industrial policy in order to work, needs to rely, in my view, on a very clear sense of trajectory about, for example, our climate policy. So not watering down our climate policy is the first element of a workable industrial policy, in my view, in this space. Second, we need to retain our competition policy as our great asset when it comes to having a well-functioning market that delivers competitive prices for consumers. And finally, we need to have an open industrial policy, again, to third countries out there that share similar needs and interest, for example, through the new instrument that the Commission has been trying to develop called Clean Trade and Investment Partnership. The first one was signed as an agreement with South Africa last year, and many other are in the pipeline. And by the way, one of the countries with whom we might want to start doing this is India. So I think we need a bit of a broader strategy in this space, which is a strategy that targets a smarter approach, more open approach to an industrial policy that cannot just be about made in Europe.
Thank you for that. Before this war broke out, before the attacks on Iran, we had been talking. There had been some serious talk that perhaps Russia would run out of money, perhaps peace talks or some sort of land for peace exchange might at least be up for discussion. Elena, it seems like all of that is completely thrown into question, and now Russia seems strengthened, as we may have heard, by the chaos elsewhere.
Indeed. On one side, Russia is strengthened by this financial inflows and the uncertainty on the oil market. And also, indeed, as my colleagues pointed out, Guntram and Simone, Russia's role in providing cheaper energy to China. China is the biggest beneficiary of recent action on sanctions by the US, whether it was fully thought, premeditated or by chance, but sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil did have an impact in terms of the spreads. Of course, those spreads will come down because of the lax enforcement, especially by the US. It inevitably happens with any sanctions, but this widening of spreads may just Russia sell cheaper oil, more discounted oil to China, because it doesn't have any alternatives to whom else to sell this oil, especially that India is much more careful in terms of not crossing the line with the US in terms of sanctions. So, of course, now this strengthens Russia's revenues and also makes Russia's role vis-a-vis China more important. And one could even say that this was part of the bigger plan by the US, again, I'm not sure by premeditated or not, of sort of squeezing out cheaper energy to China, sort of to switching off the taps, whether it's from Venezuela or Iran. One could also discuss that. Now, moving on to situation in Ukraine, actually, it's not absolutely positive for Russia, because what Russia has been doing systematically since the change in the U.S. administration is trying to get U.S. to help it out. In terms of the peace negotiation, what Russia couldn't get in terms of the military action. So Russia has been trying to conquer the territory, territory in Ukraine, and it hasn't been very successful. After the initial success of 2022, it moved a few percentage points of the territory. So it's not, it went, I think, I might make a mistake, but people can check in, in with ISW and many other places, War on the Rocks. But I think it went from 17% to 19% of the territory, right? 19.1 maybe over the last 3 years. But nonetheless, in the so-called peace negotiations, Russia has been insisting that it wants to have the full Donetsk, Lugansk territories. And this has been an important sticking point. And this is where the U.S. has come in and out, saying that Ukraine has to give up the territories without being very clear what exact territories, but potentially according to the full demand of Russia. So here Russia has a problem. U.S. is distracted elsewhere. And so while President Zelensky commented that it's likely the next round of negotiations will go ahead in Abu Dhabi, Russian authorities were saying yesterday, it's not clear we can go for the negotiations. Will they happen? U.S. is distracted. U.S. is actually waging a war on a partner of ours. Russians were showing some discontent. Basically, ideally, they would like to promise $12 trillion of investments to the U.S. That's what Dmitriev has been promising, although Russia's GDP is $2.5 trillion. So it's highly unlikely that, you know, this kind of investments could come in, right? But ideally, they would like to promise something spectacular to the U.S. and in return have U.S. steer the negotiations closer towards the Russian position. Now U.S. is distracted. And at the same time, most analysts expect this oil price spike to be short-term, which means, again, Russia doesn't become an investing case or investment case that is a medium-term. So it's not that we're expecting high commodity prices for a long time, which indeed would make Russia attractive for investments. We're expecting a short-term blip that possibly settles down at lower prices again. So for Russia, it's two sides. You know, on one side, which temporarily higher revenues. On the other side, you have U.S. distracted. And the final one is what we need to watch, to what extent Europeans will be able to buy weapons, procure weapons for Ukraine, whether some of these weapons that U.S. is using now in the Middle East will make it less available for Ukrainians to defend themselves.
What about Ukraine, Elena? The EU has not yet been able to move forward with the $90 billion package that it approved in December, in principle, because of bureaucratic delays. Meanwhile, Ukraine is stuck for money, facing its own internal political challenges, and still hoping to make the reforms necessary to move toward EU accession. How can it balance this given the sudden distractions for all of its allies?
You're absolutely right. It's a big deal. You know, the $90 billion that has been promised, which is broken down between fiscal support and military support, is important. I won't necessarily call it bureaucratic delays. I think it's a very successful campaign by Russia. And nobody said it's going to be easy to win the war with Russia for Ukraine, even with the support of the allies. I think it's a continuous pressure in negotiations with Hungary that Russia has been doing. Because let's remember, Hungary actually said it will not object. It will not take the burden of financing this borrowing, but it will also not object. And then a few weeks, months later, it came out and said, actually, we're objecting. So now negotiations are going on. Maybe also Hungary would like to get some sweetener out of these negotiations, which they have done in the past as well. I personally hope and think that this loan will be worked out one way or the other by European Union. I think that everybody is working very hard. But I would also remind two issues. One is that Ukraine has already been called to advise in terms of the protection from drones and from the missiles. It's sort of showing that how good Ukraine can actually be helpful, right? It's not just NATO helping Ukraine. It's also Ukraine helping other countries. And I also wanted to remind that we did have the training exercise by NATO in, I think it's in Estonia, that happened where Ukrainian drone commanders destroyed pretty much the few battalions in a matter of hours and days. As Wall Street Journal, I think, quoted one of the generals that were absolutely F-bomb-word in a few days. So it just shows you also that Ukraine is no longer just the receiver. It also has leadership in technology, procedures, processes, the new kind of warfare, unfortunately. And Guntram has also written a lot about that.
Just to echo this, I think what we are seeing is Iran copying some of Russian techniques and doing this much more effectively apparently now than back in June of last year when the first attack happened. I mean, now they are really successful in launching drones, in launching missiles that saturate air defense systems. And as I said, at a very positive cost ratio. So it is really calling on Western militaries to update our doctrines, defense doctrines for these kind of systems. The question is, how long will this last? I mean, to me, this is the key question. I mean, will the Iranians have enough capabilities and be able to preserve enough capabilities for more than a couple of weeks? If they do, then I think this war will last longer, and the cost for the West, in terms of military equipment, or the West, let's say the US and Israel in particular, in terms of military equipment, but then in terms of the world economy, in terms of further blockages of the Strait of Hormuz and the supply of oil, I think will be much more significant than what we are seeing now. So I find it actually very difficult at this point to say, when the US president has come out there saying it's four weeks. Okay, I mean, we've had statements by more trustworthy U.S. presidents about how quick campaigns would go, and then it ended up in years long wars, right? And so just to make this point very clear again, I think this notion that with the bombing of Iran, the Iranian people, as the president put it, can now just go and take the government that's their own, is completely sort of wishful thinking. The Iran Revolutionary Guard still has machine guns. Even if all the missiles are bombed away, you cannot just take over a government if the other side has machine guns, right? I mean, so I personally really don't think there is a plan here on the US side. And that makes it actually terrifying, because we could be in here for continued shootings, continued missiles, continued drones coming from Iran over the Strait of Hormuz towards Israel, towards Gulf, countries. And then this energy shock will be much bigger, the economic shock will be bigger, and so the whole situation will look much less manageable than I think many people think it looks now.
There's so much long-term uncertainty. But Simone, if Elena is right and energy prices come back down after initial blip, does that mean we could see some complacency for Europe in terms of making the long-term adjustments that right now seem very urgently needed?
Again, I think we need to be very clear. I mean, we might be in for just, you know, a turbulence of a few days if everything develops in a certain way, or we might be in for the mother of all energy crises if the situation goes in another direction and, you know, it takes a long time to get out of it. So I think the level of uncertainty is now extremely high. What is certain is that it is not when you are into a situation of energy turbulence, of into an energy crisis, that you can put in place the measures to, you know, to protect yourself. I mean, at that point, you just need to adapt. And how to adapt, I think, you know, if you have very little to do on the supply side, as Europe has, you need to play with the demand side. So you need to reduce consumption. That's what we did during the energy crisis. Prices by themselves will deliver demand reduction, of course, and then there might be regulatory measures to further achieve reductions if needed, protecting certain customers vis-a-vis others, etc. And then we will need to think about preparing for the next winter, you know, because now we are approaching the spring and therefore the gas consumption with its seasonality will go down in any case in Europe. And that's also why prices were pretty calm over the last weeks and months because of a warm winter. But, you know, spring, summer is when you lay the foundations of the security of supply of the next winter. So that's to say that we might be in for another period of potentially of another long period of uncertainty, and probably, you know, if certain events go in this way, high energy prices in Europe for times to come. So to be seen where we go now.
Elena, before this episode got started, we were already hearing fears from the Baltic countries and from Poland that Russia could step up its aggression toward Europe and not just in Ukraine. Will those countries be on heightened alert now? And what might be useful to think about there?
Well, I think first is we've been doing it in Bruegel already. We need to think about economics and military and security studies together. These are not parallel tracks. Economics is the war. And as you correctly point out, higher commodity prices benefit Russia, benefit directly Russia's war machine. And as Simone just pointed out, if we're going into this binary sort of scenario of prolonged and highly uncertain and high oil prices, that gives much more ammunition to Russia. $10 move on the Russian on the oil price per year gives around 1% of GDP increase in Russian revenues. This is a very simplified rule of thumb, but it's roughly there. It can be a little bit less and can be a bit more, but that is very meaningful. This is the money they can spend to invest into war and to project their power. So absolutely for the Baltic states, for all the countries, for Poland bordering Russia, but not only, you know, we've seen Russian hybrid warfare. We call it hybrid, but it's potentially very kinetic. If it shoots down your airplane over Brussels airport, right? So I think we need to think most importantly that economics is the war. It is part of the war machine in Russia. And these higher prices just mean that Russia has more resources to invest into the war. That's why I think this having the war games that happened in Estonia, in the Baltics, I think that's one of the ways that the Baltic states are trying to draw attention to the fact that we need to rethink how we rewrite our procedures for defense. You know, the old-fashioned way of doing defense is no longer working with this very sort of drone warfare and the sort of overwhelming tactics by missiles and drones that Russia and now Iran are employing.
You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. The Iran war is an ongoing situation, and you can check our website, Bruegel.org, for all of our latest thoughts and research. I'd like to thank my colleagues, Elena Rybakova, Guntram Wolf, and Simone Telia Pietra for joining me today. Thank you for listening. See you next time.